Welcome to the HD TV Podcast, featuring the HD guys, Ara Derderian and Braden Russell. Now, the HD TV Podcast.
Right, welcome to another episode of the HD TV and Home Theater Podcast. This is June 9th, episode 795. Ara, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I'm out here in California, and you are someplace else.
I am, just kind of slightly outside Chicago. I am Evanston.
In Illinois, okay.
Hanging out with my niece, who goes to Northwestern.
Oh, okay, very cool.
Yeah, a little bit. I guess it's kind of a vacation-ish sort of thing. No, we had fun. She took me to Chicago today and showed me around, and I've actually never been to the city of Chicago.
Chicago's a very cool city. I like it. I was born there, and I have relatives who live there, so I still go back and visit from time to time. We always have a good time when we go to Chicago, and I'm a Bears fan because growing up, my dad was a huge Chicago Bears fan, and that kind of transferred over to me. And however, that's the only sport from Chicago that transferred over. Everything else, I'm all L.A.
I'm all L.A. for everything anyways. Yeah. So
Now, speaking of that, for the NHL playoffs, I've been the Predators because the Kings didn't make it. They're my team. And so my daughter kind of introduced us to Nashville. We went there for vacation last summer, and then we went back at Christmas to watch LA Kings play the Nashville Predators. So I said to the girls, if the Predators get in the final, we will go to a game. They're in the final. In fact, as we are recording, they're losing to Pittsburgh right now 3-0 in the first period. So I told my daughters, go ahead and scream if they score a goal, so then at least I'll know they scored a goal. But I just heard the goal horn go off, so that's Pittsburgh. That's how I know it's 3-0. But anyway, my youngest daughter, who's the one who introduced us to Nashville, is not able to go because she's got summer school. So my oldest daughter and I, we're going to go, and my wife's going to stay home with Grace, and she's a little bit disappointed that you guys are going. I'm the one who told you guys about Nashville, and now you guys are going. It's not fair.
It was all my idea.
Exactly. So yeah. One thing we found out is the tickets are prohibitively expensive, so we're not actually going to be able to go to the game. Unless someone who listens to the show happens to be with the Nashville Predators organization and wants to hook me up. But barring that, we're going to go. They have this area downtown. It's right next to the Bridgestone Arena. And it's kind of like a 4th of July festival. And they've got big screens set up. And I said, you know what? I'll go there and we'll have some fun. So Nashville is quickly becoming my home away from home.
So you're flying to Nashville to watch the game on TV?
Sort of. Okay. We're also going because, one, we're going to have a good time there. There's going to be a little bit different vibe in the streets of Nashville, drinking and having a good time, as opposed to sitting on my couch drinking and having a good time. Does that sound bad?
No, I imagine, you know, being surrounded by other fans who are into it and everything, the atmosphere would be totally different. So,
and if somehow the Predators can have a miraculous comeback in this game, it's the potential that they could win and win the whole Stanley Cup, and that place will be incredible. So, what the heck? You know, you only live once, and so why waste it on sleep? We're taking the red eye Friday night, her and I. We'll get there Saturday morning. We'll hang out, go downtown, have dinner. It'll be a cool bonding trip for me and my daughter.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
All right, so enough about my hockey and everything. And we already visited, so let's get into the show. What do you say?
Let's do it. So there are ways that you can support the show if you're listening and want to help out. One of the ways you can do that is by visiting Patreon, and that's patreon.com/HDTV podcast, and signing up to be a patron of the HDTV and Home Theater Podcast. And we would appreciate it. And all those who have done it, we thank you very, very much. It helps quite a bit.
And you can also, if you shop at Amazon, please go to our website first and use our Amazon banner. If you've got an ad blocker, please turn that off. Otherwise, you won't see the banner. You can turn it off just for our site, so you know it won't be too much of an inconvenience. And also, if you like shopping through the mobile app, if you go to our site first and then click on the link, it'll launch your mobile app. So we got you covered that way as well. Also, you can support us via a CAFPOW, which is like a coffee / super caffeinated drink metaphor. And this week, there weren't any. So with a CAFPOW, you get a little bit of a shout out. It could be anything you want. As long as it's legal, we'll say it on the air.
Yep, but nothing this week. So we'll jump right into email. And our first one is from Mike. And he has a comment on what we talked about last week on what pro installers sell. We talked about the best brands according to CE Pro magazine. And Mike says, I suspect at least some of what goes on the pro installers list of preferred products depends on profit margin, as well as the quality of the product or customer requests. This may also include money that can be made on services around these products, like control programming and product integration. And that was an interesting point I hadn't thought of before. So yeah, profit margin obviously is huge for installers, and quality, so you aren't having to go out and constantly repair or replace things. But the add-on services is probably a good moneymaker for them. So that's,
yeah, you know, like if you're programming a remote control or some home automation, setting up macros and that kind of thing. But one thing is true. They don't want to sell products that are flaky, because that's just going to cause them to go out there, and they typically will guarantee their work. And if something's not working, they have to go back out and service it. So, you know, yes, the margins are important, but also the reliability of a product is important as well.
Yeah, and nothing kills your margins like having to go out multiple times on support calls, because you can't charge for those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, then we also talked about Redbox renting discs, and how there was some agreement with the studios that they would wait 28 days, and you surmised, Braden, why don't they just go buy the discs? And what Matt sent us an email, he said Redbox is voluntarily delaying the requests, the rentals, in exchange for cheaper discs, or maybe sharing revenue from the rental. So there's another money angle to it there as well. They have the legal rights to rent the discs. That's called first sale doctrine. So that could be the reason why. I think we asked on the show, well, why don't they just go do that? And it's obviously, again, everything comes down to dollars. So if they're going to make more money by waiting, then that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, so I had to go back and refresh my memory, because I remember back in the day when a lot of this was going down, Blockbuster was still a thing, and the studios weren't forcing Blockbuster to have the same delay that they were putting on Netflix and Redbox. And it did turn out that Redbox for a while was going out to Target and Walmart and other places and buying up a bunch of discs, but the studios put pressure on the stores to put a limit on how many they could sell, like per person or something, and it just made it really cumbersome. So Redbox had to go back to the studio and say, okay, well, let's make a deal. Studio said, yeah, great, we'll sell you really cheap discs that you can rent out, but you got to wait 28 days for it. So it was a little bit of strong-arming, I think, from the studio, but it did end up that they get the discs at a cheaper price if they agreed to that 28-day wait. All right. And next up is Robert has a comment on Monoprice speakers. He says, you guys have mentioned Monoprice many times in the past. I wanted to tell you about the Alpha Carbon Fiber In-Ceiling 2-Way 8-Inch speakers I recently purchased and installed. In short, they are awesome for $90 a pair. I upgraded my 5.1 system to a 7.1 by adding these speakers behind the viewing position, but they're good enough to be front channel speakers. They also look very nice because they're low profile and have magnetic grills to easily remove if you need to adjust the speakers. We'll throw a link up to those on the website. And then he goes a little bit into a different topic, says, you guys talked about a new Sony OLED TV that produces sound through the screen using transducers behind the screen. When I first heard about that at CES, I thought it would be really cool if the sound was much better than the tiny speakers you get in most flat panels. But then I wondered if the small amount of vibration on the screen to produce a sound would affect the video quality in any way. You know what I mean if you've watched a subwoofer in action. That is an interesting question. On the screen would have to vibrate in order to produce the sound. But if it, you know, gets really loud, can you actually see the vibrations in the screen? Like an explosion goes off, does the screen go wobbly? I don't know. I hadn't even thought about that. It's an interesting question.
I would have to think there's some electronics and or firmware that deals with that. I mean, because they can see the wave coming in, and they probably know what they need to do to adjust the vibration or minimize the vibration. That's just my guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think people would last with that TV for very long if when you cranked up the volume or explosions happened, everything on the screen went all wiggly.
Not at all. Not at all. And he's right. If you watched a subwoofer rattle a window, you'll know exactly what it's talking. Now, likewise, I don't think the levels are going to get that loud. I think it's just so that like you a normal listening thing. So in fact, probably it doesn't have much low frequency. So I don't know that it's going to matter that much, but we'll have to wait. We'll keep an eye on that when that TV actually gets released. All right. With that, we move over to the news, and Apple had a developer conference, and they did release some new products. In fact, one of those was a HomePod, which is a smart speaker designed to compete with the Amazon Echo and Google Home. The connected speaker uses Siri voice controls and learns users' habits and can be used to control home technology and will reinvent home audio. That's according to Tim Cook, who's the CEO at Apple. Now, I saw this and I was kind of happy about it till I saw the price. $300. They must be smoking some special kind of crack up at Apple. Why would I pay $300 for it? And they're arguing that the audio quality is really good. But the thing is, I don't think most people buy an Echo or a Google Home for the audio quality. I think they buy it because of the convenience of being able to tell it to do something. And I think you've said your wife has some speakers in the kitchen, as we do. And while we're doing stuff, entertaining or getting things ready, we just have music in the background. So we don't need that super high quality in that environment. I just don't see people spending the that kind of money for that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think when you look at it and you compare all three of them side by side, if one of them is ridiculously more expensive, it's going to be a tough sell.
The only cool thing is it's got a little bit of processing in, and it could be used to be your hub for your home automation, you know, HomeKit. You need a Apple TV to be able to use your HomeKit away from the home. They could move that into the pod, the HomePod, but even still with that, it's just not worth it to me to spend $300. I will get one for review, as it is, everything, and granted, some of the information is still a little bit limited right now. I don't see how on earth that's going to replace my Echo at all.
Yeah, and this is coming from someone who kind of has pretty much everything Apple makes, right?
So it's, exactly.
If you're not willing to buy it or pay the extra for it, it's going to be a tough sell for them.
Well, and the thing that does have advantage over the Echo and Google is because all my music's in Apple Music, it's still not that much of a... I still can't see spending that money just so I have access to my Apple Music through this device, because I do have Airport Expresses. I can get to my music that way. But likewise, I have Amazon Prime. I've got a lot of music there too. So it just doesn't matter.
Right. All right. So Optima has released a new 4K projector that uses an updated DLP chip to deliver a 3840 by 2160 pixel resolution for the low, low price of $1,999. That's almost $2,000. There's no decimal in there. It's $1,999. It's the 4K UHD 60 projector. Now, it uses internal mirrors to provide higher resolution rather than working on a traditional natively ultra-high def system. So it's another one of those kind of tricks to get it to 4K, which is why the price is so low. The native 4K projectors are significantly more expensive. But you can get 4K on the screen for $2,000.
This reminds me of that wobulation that HP did. Do you remember back in the day when HP had a DLP? And the article, I went a little more in depth about it. It does say that it's better than the fake 4K, but it's not as good as a true 4K. So it's in between. And I think as far as resolution goes, it's fine, because resolution is not that big a deal. Now, on a projector, obviously, it could be a little bit more because you can have a big screen. So I think that gets you good enough. As long as that thing has HDR and wide color, I think that's a viable 4K projector, if you ask me. $2,000 for something that's close to 4K and gets you the HDR and wide color, I'm in.
Yeah.
All right, so Oppo Digital announced that its UDP 203 and 205 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray disc players can now receive a firmware upgrade that enables Dolby Vision. The new firmware makes the Oppo 203 and 205 the first Blu-ray discs to support Dolby Vision, to support Dolby Vision. The addition of the Oppo Blu-ray player to the Dolby Vision ecosystem is a major milestone that will provide expanded choice and accessibility for consumers. That, according to Roland Viaku, Vice President of Consumer Entertainment Group at Dolby Laboratories, with Ultra HD Blu-ray, we are able to scale faster to meet a growing demand of Dolby Digital Vision content globally. Customers who already have an internet connection that are set up for the players can directly upgrade by answering the player's prompt on the TV screen or from the player setup menu. And customers who do not connect their players to the internet can visit Oppo Digital's website, download the firmware or request a firmware CD. The 203 and 205 are available for purchase at Oppo Digital's website or from Oppo Digital authorized retailers. So that's one thing about Oppo. I like they build their products to have enough horsepower to do this kind of stuff. It's a little bit more expensive than, say, a Sony or Panasonic Ultra HD player, but I think there's a lot of support for these things, and you now can do Dolby HDR as well as the regular HDR10.
Yeah, and the cool thing about Oppo too is that they've never met a format they didn't like. I mean, the Oppo player can play pretty much any format of anything you can throw at it. So if you get one and it doesn't support that format, this is, you know, they have firmware upgrades that'll get it for you. I think that's pretty cool. And a change for DirecTV Now users. DirecTV Now is informing subscribers that they will only be able to access live streaming channels on computers and laptops using the Google Chrome browser starting at the end of June, if not sooner. The quote says, "For our best streaming experience, DirecTV Now will live exclusively on Google Chrome when accessed via your computer." DirecTV Now's Twitter customer service team wrote this week, "DirecTV Now did not provide more reasons for the restriction other than to say Google Chrome will ensure the quote-unquote best streaming experience. But some DirecTV Now subscribers have said they experience picture interruptions and login issues when using Explorer and Safari. Some subscribers have also evidently complained about Chrome as well. And some subscribers have responded angrily on Twitter, saying they prefer Explorer or Safari and wouldn't have signed up for DirecTV Now had they known they would be forced to use Chrome. Chrome is a, here's a quote from someone on Twitter that says, "Chrome is a battery hog, and I don't trust Google with my data. This is unacceptable." So do you think there's more, there's got to be more to it, more than just the quote-unquote best streaming experience? They probably have better access to like DLP or protections of the streams in Chrome than they do in other browsers?
There's got to be something else to it. It's easier. I don't know. Now, one thing, they use Silverlight, and on Safari, for whatever reason, you have to kind of say it's okay to use it, because by default, Safari will turn that and Flash off. It's a little bit annoying that every now and then when I go to a site, I have to click, okay, go ahead and turn it. And then there's a thing that says, use it every time. So I click use it every time. And every single time I go back, I still have to approve it. So I think it's more of a headache, at least on the Safari side. I don't know about the Internet Explorer side. So bottom line is, I think, Braden, you're right. It's the easiest for them, and it probably is the best experience as far as you just go to the website and it works.
Yeah, plus the fact that you're right. You know, from a maintenance and development perspective, if you have to test your product across a bunch of different browsers and a bunch of different versions, it just slows you down, right? So when you've got, you know, the higher ups, the execs asking, "How come we can't do this stuff faster?" And the response back is, "Well, we support, you know, all these different browsers and all these different versions, and we have to make sure it works everywhere and test it everywhere." Someone's going to say, "Well, I'll just pick one. Let's just go with one of them and make it work."
Exactly. No, now today, before I told you I was watching the game before we started recording, there was a commercial, Spectrum Cable here in Southern California, and they were kind of had these like evil characters sitting around a poker table, and they were saying, "Hey, can you hit pause on it?" The TV was on in the background, and the guy goes, "Nope, I can't pause. I can't rewind. There's no DVR. You know, we have DirecTV Now." And then they said, "What do you mean you can't do that?" And they said, "Spectrum has a DVR, blah, blah, blah." And he says, "Not allowing you to pause and rewind, that's just evil." And so I just thought it was kind of funny that they are now targeting DirecTV Now, showing the limitations of that product, because they must be losing subscribers to this platform.
Yeah, you wouldn't create an ad if it wasn't a threat.
Exactly. All right, so we found an article over at Electronic House. It's 5 smart lights that you can control with your Amazon Alexa or Google Assistant. This is one of the things that I really like about the Echo. Let's say you're walking in and you've got your hands full, right? You can just say, "Alexa, turn on the kitchen lights." I'm sorry, anyone who had an Echo, I apologize. I got to remember to not do that.
Yeah, and has it connected to your kitchen lights? But
right,
you're
somebody's
welcome.
Kitchen
on now.
Lights turned on. I apologize. Yeah. So anyway, so you tell the Echo to turn on your kitchen lights. It's a very cool feature. I also like the timers. You know how a kitchen can have, you know, on the oven, you can have a timer. I also think now this is turning into an Echo ad, but one of the cool things is I can say set a timer for 20 minutes, and then sometimes you have to do something halfway through, and it says take it out and whatever. So you can set another timer for halfway through. It's really cool, and you do it all with voice. And so anyway, this article talks about five smart lights that you can control, and we thought it was kind of cool. So we'll just kind of go through these lights. The first one is a TP-Link smart LED light bulb, and it offers two voice-controlled options, one from Amazon and one from Google, and you can provide lighting equivalent of 50 watts of an incandescent bulb, and it can be controlled via a companion app or through the Echo. It's $20 for a light bulb, and I know that seems like a lot of money, but I've got some LED lights that I put in. I don't think I'm going to have to change those things for 20 or 30 years. So once you get over the initial sticker shock, you start saving. And I did notice once I did that, my electric bill did go down. It was a noticeable amount.
Nice. And the next product on here is the Leviton DW1KD-1BZ Decora Smart Wi-Fi Universal LED Incandescent Dimmer. So it's actually a dimmer switch, not a light bulb, but it can be connected both to Amazon the Echo or to the Google Assistant, and it comes with the free iOS or Android app, so you can name devices and control them, set up scenes, but the switch itself is going to set you back around $65.
All right, then there's the Flex Smart Wi-Fi LED light bulb, and this is cool because you can add colors, so colors can be added to your Amazon Echo vocabulary. With the Flex Smart LED bulb, its light output is comparable to a 40-watt incandescent bulb, and the color palette has over 16 million colors, plus tones of white are available at your fingertips, and that will set you back about $40. I bought, Braden, a lighting system for that supports HomeKit, and the lights are pretty, having the colors are pretty cool, but what this thing has is you could put it into a mode, like say sunset, and it just kind of, the colors change from like orange to red, and then it just kind of goes back and it just goes through. It's a really cool system. I really like the colors. The hue is another one of those. And this one for like $40, maybe you got a couple light bulbs in your house, and you could probably set up some scenes, and you can say, morning mode, and it would have a certain light, and evening mode, it will also have a different light. So I think that's kind of where we're going.
All right, and the next one on the list is the Wemo light switch, and it's, you know, like the Leviton, it's a switch, so it could control pretty much anything that a traditional light switch can control. Using the free Wemo app, you can schedule your lights to turn off at sunrise or synchronize your front light with the sunset so you never come home to a dark house. It can also be paired with Nest's thermostat so that when the Nest thermostat knows you're away, it can tell the switch to turn off the lights for you. And of course, you can control it with your phone or tablet or through Google Home or the Amazon Echo. And this switch is a little bit less expensive. It's only around $50.
And the last one is a LIFX, or it's spelled LIFX, LED colored light strips. So you got bulbs, you got switches, but this one is a strip, and it is allows you to tuck this maybe under your cabinets. Even I've seen them sometimes under couches and whatnot, or behind even a TV. You can have, if you've got a 1 meter strip, you can put as many as 8 different colors on there. So it's kind of cool. I really like the strips because it allows you to put lighting in places that you'd normally wouldn't. And you can totally set the mood. This is about $90. So there are some lighting that you can control with your voice. And if you do something like that, let us know. I'm a big fan of it, to be honest with you. I'm having a lot of fun with the Amazon Echo and the different lighting modes. All right. So today we've got an interview with David Dix of Common Sense Audio. And I just built a new set of speakers. If you go to our website, we'll have some information about the drivers that I use and a picture of them. I personally think, and it's not just me patting myself on the back, these are some beautiful looking speakers. Please go to the website and check it out. And so I exchanged some emails with David, and I said, you know what? You got a lot of knowledge. Would you mind coming on the show and we talk about full range speakers? And if you are interested in building some speakers, he does share some great knowledge with us. So let's go to that now. All right. We'd like to welcome to the show David Dix. He's the owner of Common Sense Audio. And David, welcome to the show.
That's nice to be here.
Thank you for doing this recording. I have been on a journey to learn about building speakers. And along the way, I came across full-range speakers, which is something that your company has quite a bit of information and knowledge and experience with. And I bought the Audio Nirvana Classic 5-inch speaker or drivers, and I just loved them so much. We exchanged some emails back and forth. You helped me out with a couple of things, and I thought it'd be great if you would come on the show and tell us a little bit about your journey into this field.
Sure. Well, just to back up, I mean, I've been in audio about 50 years. I'm actually 66 years old now, and the journey started years ago. A friend and I started to find out what the best speakers and amplifiers were. There was a place in Richmond, Virginia called Audio Mart before there was the internet, and everybody would buy and sell vintage stuff there. And over some years, we bought everything we heard was the best, and we listened and kept what we liked and sold the rest. And in this journey, we discovered coaxial speakers, which is a speaker with a tweeter built into the center. And these were the best of the best, and started building cabinets for those. And then we heard there was a couple of companies that made these without tweeters, full-range speakers, Louder and Fostex and some others. And we bought these, and they were even better. So that began the journey, and we started selling other companies' speakers. But they weren't perfect, and we thought we could do better. And 15 years ago, we started designing our own. And we now have 28 models from 3 inches all the way up to 15 inches. We're the only company in the world that's ever made true full-range speakers that are larger than 8 inches. So we make 10s, 12s, and 15s.
And so, you know, my very first speaker build I ever did was a speaker that had a woofer and a tweeter. And I bought a crossover. It was from Parts Express. It was one of their pre-configured crossover. And I just picked, you know, 2.5 kilohertz for the crossover. And I got a lot of feedback, a lot of it very constructive, some of it not so much, telling me that, oh, you're leaving so much performance on the table, that crossover is no good. And you know, I kind of got intimidated. I mean, people were nice. And then my research led me to full-range drivers. I put some in some speakers, and I was blown away by how good it sounded. Not only did it sound good, I got this imaging of a stereo imaging. It was as if I had a speaker on the left and on the right, and it was as if the band was literally right in the middle. And I had never experienced that with not only the speakers I built, but any other speakers for that matter.
Well, I mean, I agree with you totally. When I first heard a good coaxial many, many years ago, all of a sudden the boxes disappeared and the band appeared before me. And I realized I was already in my 40s, but I realized I didn't know what stereo was until that time. You know, it's not the piano on the left and the guitar on the right. It's the complete disappearance of the speakers and the appearance of the group before you. And it's really almost impossible to achieve with multi-driver speakers because crossovers have delays in them. They have phase anomalies. They have all these problems, and the sound is coming from two or three different places on each speaker, and it's just impossible for it to disappear and to have the band appear. But when the sound comes from a single point in space on the left and the right, it's very easy to reproduce the recording perfectly and for the speakers to pull a disappearing act. And that's why we've settled on full-range speakers. And to be honest with you, I've never heard of any customer that got into full-range speakers over the years. We've been doing this for 20 years, who ever went back to multi-driver speakers. Excuse me. Everyone agrees that a crossover is an evil. Nobody thinks a crossover is good or will make the sound better. So if you can get rid of it entirely, why would you use it? The only argument against it is that you can't have a speaker that goes full range. But that's not true. There's many companies that make them. And once people take the time to listen, they'll never go back to multi-driver speakers.
Now, one of the things I learned in this research, and from you specifically, was that
the larger speaker, the larger driver will actually have better high frequency response. And that was, to me, it was kind of counterintuitive. When you get a larger driver, I always think better bass, but you're telling me that the larger speakers will give you frequencies beyond what you can hear.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. Our full range speakers are different than any other company that makes full range. Other companies' smaller full range speakers will be more detailed and more extended. But this never made any sense to me because as the cone gets bigger, you'll get more bass. So if you want to have the proper balance, you need to have more mid-range and treble for that balance. So our 3s and 4s are our least detailed speakers, and our 12 and 15 are our most detailed speakers. And people don't think it's possible, but it is possible. I mean, it just takes one listen to see. People have often asked me, you know, why does your 15 sound the best? And I have no real reason, you know, we can't say this scientifically because speaker design is 90% art, 10% science, but I think a 15-inch cone is closer in size to what it's trying to reproduce. A guitar, a violin, a bass, the size of the cone is closer to the real instrument. So why should we be surprised that it sounds better doing it than say, a 1-inch or a 2-inch dome tweeter? How is that supposed to sound like a Gibson Country Western acoustic guitar? It's just not possible. So we try to maintain balance in each of our sizes so that the 3 will have less mid-range to go with the less bass it makes, and the 15 will have the most mid-range and treble to go with the more bass that it has.
Okay, and I can tell you from my limited experience with the full range, I've built 2 speakers that are full range. Both of them have sounded great. The latest one I did is using your Classic 5s. I can tell you there's a lot of reasons you wouldn't want to go back to the coaxial. Like you said, you know, you don't go back. Well, one, it's easier to build from the point of view of electronics. Now, the cabinets have a little bit more complexity. My cabinet was just a very basic rectangle, if you will, with a vent tube in it, but I've seen some of these cabinets are very elaborate. Can you describe what the different cabinets are and why some of them are very elaborate, what they're trying to do with that?
Well, there's many different cabinet designs, but 99.99% of all speaker cabinets ever made are bass reflex. So I think the jury's really in on this. That's the same percentage as cars with 4 wheels. I think that people still build bass horn cabinets and open baffles and other designs because they look cool. You know, this hobby is not just about music. It is for me. I'm a musicophile. I'm not an audiophile. But a lot of people in the hobby are more interested in the way things look. They're like people that collect cars but never drive them. So, you know, a bass horn speaker is the answer to a question that no longer exists. When they were first designed in the 1920s and 30s, amplifiers were less than a watt, and you had to magnify the sound as much as possible. But it's a non-issue today, and they have many problems. So I think at the end of the day, a well-designed, which there's a lot of poorly designed bass reflex on the market, but a well-designed bass reflex will give the best sound. And that's what we promote mostly. And they're very hard to design, but they're easy to build. At the end of the day, they're 6 pieces of wood with a couple of holes cut in them. So they're quite easy to build once we figured out, you know, what they should be.
And the cool thing here is if you buy a set of drivers from you, you've got proven designs that you can, that you provide to, I think you can choose a design and you've got a list of what they are. And for each set of drivers, you have suggested these are the designs that work best for this driver. So in some cases, or in all cases, you can't go wrong. It's just a matter of, like you said, can you cut the boards to the appropriate lengths, put them together, and you're pretty much done.
Yeah, the work's already done. We've got, I don't know, between 15 and 20 different designs from 0.41 cubic feet up to 13.6 cubic feet. And we supply the plans, parts list, setup tips, and also pictures showing how the damping material should be installed inside. So they're very easy to duplicate, again, once we've done all the work. And we're there to help each customer adapt the cabinet a little bit to their room. Bass reflex tuning, We design for the average room and the average situation, but some customers have difficult rooms, and the port, the hole, the tuned hole or port on it, can be adjusted by adding tubes and make it perfect for every customer's room. This is something you don't read about or see in the stores, but the same cabinet is not going to work equally well in any room.
And one thing that prompted me to have you on the show was I sent you a picture of my the speakers that I built, and you liked them, but you offered me some advice on, here, do this and do this. One of the things you suggested was I had four-inch tubes, port tubes, and I went based on a calculator that was online, and you said, you know, ignore that calculator. It's wrong. It can't really account for the things that are going on in your house. My recommendation is cut the ports to be flush with the thickness of your baffle, and just let the air out, and you'll get better bass. And I was like, all right, it's, you know, they're 98 cents a piece. Let me just cut it. If they don't sound good, I'll just replace them with the other ones. And it was immediate night and day difference that I could tell I am getting way more bass out of it. And that just seems so counterintuitive to what everybody else was saying online.
Well, it is. It's, again, 90% art, 10% science. A couple of things important to understand about bass reflex. None of these speaker design programs work. None of them. And the reason they don't work is that you'll be shocked to learn that there are no industry standards, no firm industry standards for testing the drive units, the loudspeakers themselves. In other words, there's no standard test temperature, no standard humidity, no standard test baffle, no standard anechoic chamber. So the numbers you get are ballpark at best. This is from every manufacturer. So even if this computer program to design a box worked, the numbers you're using are so general in nature that the end results are not meaningful. So what you do is you build the cabinet from experience, what you think will work, and you listen. If you're getting too much mid-bass, you add a port tube, which has the effect of making the hole smaller, and you get rid of the mid-bass hump. If you're not getting enough mid-bass, you need to enlarge the hot size of the hole, or if you have a tube, remove it or shorten it, and this will give more mid-bass. So it's quite easy to do. We recommend usually rather large ports on our cabinets. Then if the customer has a problem, it's easy to add a tube. This is a better solution than having the customer cut a hole that's too small and then telling him he has to enlarge the hole, which is much more difficult to do. But again, this is all done by experience and then trial and error by listening. You can't use computers. You can't use test equipment. By the way, just an aside, when we've developed over 50 different models of full-range speakers, we make many, many prototypes, and I have a panel of people that listen, and we do not look at the specifications. And at the end of the day, if one of them is great and we want to sell it, then we look at the specifications, and we often find out that it may be the one that looks worst on paper, but it just sounds absolutely wonderful. So there's zero connection between specifications and how a speaker actually sounds. There's only a couple of things in there that I look at, like free air resonance and stuff, to begin the process of designing a cabinet. But in general terms, forget specifications, use your ears. That's the only way to find what's best.
And so some of my listeners are going to ask, well, that you're making full-range speakers sound like they're perfect, they're the holy grail. There's got to be a trade-off. Is there a trade-off in using full-range versus coaxial?
Well, I mean, there's some trade-offs in everything. I mean, but very few with full-range. One thing is that full-range speakers, the way they work is they have very short excursion, or XMAX. In other words, the cone doesn't move in and out a lot. The only downside of this is, as a general rule, to get the same amount of bass from a given cabinet size, you'll need a cabinet that's twice the volume as one using a normal woofer. But the upside is, because of the short movement of the cone, it's much quicker, faster, and more musical, and more like the real thing than you get from a woofer. We sell many of them to bass guitar players, And they've told me that it's the only speaker they've ever heard where they can identify individual bass notes as opposed to bass tones or bass noise or whatever. So, I mean, there's some things like that where you need more volume. But other than that, you don't need a crossover. You only have to buy one pair of speakers. I don't really see any downside to them, neither do my customers. We've sold 20,000 pairs with 100% money-back guarantee. I've gotten 7 pairs back in 15 years. So there's not really any downside to it.
I'm keeping these, and I'm probably going to order some more. One thing we talked about through our email exchange is the break-in, because I've noticed that you recommend, I think it was like 30 hours of playing music at a very low volume and then gradually increasing it. So after I did that, it sounded really good. But as I continue to listen, it almost as if it gets better every time I listen to it. Is there a period where, you know, I read an article that said some speakers take a year to break in. Is that a real thing, or can I expect these things to sound better a year from now?
Yeah, they'll be better 10 years from now. They'll be better 20 years from now. The main thing with break-in, there's two parts of a break-in. One is the surround and the spider. These are the two things that support the cone. The other is the actual windings of the wire around the voice coil. We choose to use a treated accordion cloth surround. It's an Altec type of design that's been made for 70, 80 years. I use it because it has the longest reliability. They'll last like, design life is 50 years on our speakers, as opposed to foam surrounds, which might last 5 to 10 years. So they take longer to break in, but they'll last indefinitely. They'll last your lifetime. So we say 30 hours at moderate levels. After 100 hours, we consider them broken in, but really 5, 10 years from now, they'll sound better and better with each year. I've actually, back in my collecting period, bought 50-year-old Altec speakers that were all original, and they sounded better than they would have when they were new.
Okay, so for some of our listeners, how would you go about evaluating the speaker? What type of music, what should you listen for? You know, because there's all these graphs, these charts that show frequency response, and I think you said you don't care about that nearly as much as how does it sound. So what would you do if I'm going to sit down and listen to music? How should I do that?
Well, very good question. First of all, your listeners need to be aware that recording quality is all over the map, and you need to evaluate speakers only with the highest quality recordings. I tell people it's like if you bought a Ferrari, you're not going to go test drive it on pockmarked city streets. You're going to find a wonderful country curvy road to evaluate it. Same thing with speakers. One thing I haven't mentioned for you before, but we have on our site, we have a reference list of very high-quality CDs. There's more than 100 listed there. We don't sell them. It's just a list that customers can go to find a great recording to evaluate. Generally speaking, I like to find a recording that has a lot of bass, a lot of highs, that has both male or female vocals, so that you can evaluate the entire range of what the speakers are capable of. You can't adjust the cabinet tuning of the box, for instance, the bass, unless you're listening to something that's rather bass heavy. Contemporary jazz group like 4Play is just wonderful. There's some genres of music that are hard to find great recordings. Rock music is generally not well recorded, but there's a lot of live recordings, something they call direct to two-track, that can be really great. So that's a good reference, but do not try to evaluate your speakers with MP3s or any kind of poor quality recording. Find the best quality recordings.
All right, and also we'll wrap it up here with, you also sell amplifiers on there, and I saw you have some tube amps. Do you have any solid state amps? Tell me about the amps that you have and how they can enhance the music as well.
Well, we didn't want to sell amplifiers, but your listeners should be aware that most of the tube amps sold today are very poorly done. And I say that having done this for 50 years, the guys today don't know how to design tube amps because they have no one to learn from. They go to tube books. So we reluctantly got into it, but we have a 300B single-ended triode, and we have a 6V6 ultralinear. I also sell, there's a company in Taiwan called Firestone Audio that makes very good quality Class D amplifiers for very little money, some with built-in DACs, and we sell those as well. But our tube amps are, they're designed with our speakers, so we shouldn't be surprised that they sound best with them, because a full-range speaker presents a very easy load for an amplifier to drive. Therefore, you can make some choices in the design of the amplifier that you might not do with a very inefficient multi-driver speaker. So we want great bass, and our amps have like solid-state type Krell-like bass and extended highs, but they have this beautiful open mid-range that makes you think the singer is right in front of you and they're alive. And it's hard to do. I'm not the speaker expert. I have an engineer that's the amplifier expert, but we reluctantly sell them because it's hard for customers to find good tube amps anywhere else.
Well, that's great information. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm listening on a Audio Engine N22. It's a really nice amp and it sounds good, but one of these days I may have to try it with a tube amp to see how that sounds. So where could our listeners go to find more information about your company and the products that you guys sell?
Well, our speakers, we trademarked the name. It's Audio Nirvana, and that's our full-range line of speakers. There's like 28 models, and our amplifiers are also Audio Nirvana. The company started many years ago as Common Sense Audio. There was a name suggested by a customer who told us we were the only audio company he'd ever run into that had any common sense, because our prices are low, and yet we sell the world's best-sounding equipment. So commonsenseaudio.com will get you to our site, and then you can click on the Audio Nirvana speaker link or the Audio Nirvana amplifier link.
Oh, excellent. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I will probably be talking to you soon about some more designs and speakers. I think the next one I'm going to build is an 8-inch one. You said the 8-inch one will even sound much better than the 5-inch one that I have.
It will, and it's our best seller. It's the most popular size for full-range speakers for customers. And by the way, your listeners are welcome to get in touch with me at any time. They don't have to buy anything. I'm happy to discuss anything they want to talk about. I enjoy interacting with people, so if they just want some advice or information, I'm available.
Right, and that's at commonsenseaudio.com. So David Dix, owner of Common Sense Audio, thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, David, for that. That was a fantastic interview. Brayton, he's a little controversial. There's a lot of talk in the industry about full range versus using separate subwoofer. I'm sorry, a woofer and a tweeter mid-range. And he's got some opinions. And I'll tell you, listening with my own ears, I kind of lean in his camp. I am a big fan, and I'm going to probably just build these full-range speakers going forward. I'm really happy with the sound. And the next time you're here in this house, I can't wait to play these for you.
Awesome. Can't wait to hear them. So thank you, Aura, for recording that, and David for joining Aura on the show. Great stuff. And everyone else, thank you for listening. Go watch some HDTV.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, I just remembered that I forgot to mention the contest that we have, the giveaway of the Barnwood speakers that I built, the desktop speakers. If you'd like to see what they're about, you can go to the HT Guys on YouTube and look for DIY desktop Barnwood speakers, and you'll see them. We're giving those away. All you need to do to enter the contest is send us an email and put Barnwood speakers in the subject line, and you'll be entered. We will be giving those away. We'll announce the winner on the June 30th show. And we are only mentioning this on the podcast. We're not posting it on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. So there will be a low number of entrants, so you have a much better chance of winning. So if you want to enter, send us an email and you'll be rewarded for listening all the way till the end. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the HDTV and Home Theater Podcast with Ara Derderian and Brayden Russell. If you're not already a subscriber, find the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast aggregator. In social media, look them up on Facebook and on Twitter at HDTV Podcast. to contact Ara or Braden for questions and feedback, email htguys@htguys.com. And they're on the web at htguys.com. Again, be sure to subscribe. And thanks for listening to the HDTV and Home Theater Podcast.